macro policies and the world-known scientific models should be used to solve the problems. In the end, Mehralizadeh referred to economic problems of people, but asked them to go to the polls to use the right of democracy to solve such issues. Some 60 million Iranians are eligible to vote in the 13th presidential election, which is slated to be held on June 18th. Mouman Abedi, Tehran.
Benjamin Netanyahu's 12-year reign as Israel's prime minister is much likely to end on Sunday. Naftali Bennett, a far-right politician leading Yamina party, and Yair Lapid, a centrist and opposition leader of Yesh Atid party, moved closer to forming a coalition after four inconclusive parliamentary elections in 2 years, and Netanyahu's repeated failure to form a coalition.
Shamati Naftali Bennett.
Netanyahu accused Bennett of trying to form a leftist ruling structure that would ensure his rise to premiership. He said that Bennett had been sowing discord, division, and hatred against him.
There are many reasons behind efforts by the Israeli parties working together to oust Netanyahu. He has always declared himself as the only leader of Israel. He has no rival even within his own party. Meanwhile, he has failed to form a coalition so far. Therefore, removing him from the political scene could serve as a strong blow on the Likud and Netanyahu himself.
Bennett said his party would work with the opposition leaders to build an alternative cabinet. Observers say the alliance between eight relatively small parties with a diffuse range of ideologies won't be easy. But if they succeed, they had agreed that the prime minister's post would rotate between Bennett, a former settler leader who rejects the concept of a sovereign Palestinian state and champions the religious right, and Lapid, who is considered a voice of secular centrists.
It's not an easy mission. We are speaking about the ideological differences between two opposition parties. That's a complex decision for Bennett. They have to tackle lots of problems before forming a cabinet. Moreover, Netanyahu won't remain silent. He may take people with right-wing tendency to the streets to hamper efforts by any future cabinet.
Netanyahu has been holding on to power for the past 12 years. His popularity has, however, suffered an unprecedented plunge among the Israelis, who have been holding regular rallies outside his residence for months on end to force him to resign. Today, experts say nothing must be taken for granted because what's being described as the anti-Netanyahu cabinet of change is still not an accomplished fact. They say Netanyahu is not simply departing the scene without a fight for remaining in office. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
South Korea is hosting the P4G Seoul Summit on Climate Change, bringing together leaders from more than 60 countries. Held both offline and online, the meeting sought, quote, inclusive green recovery toward carbon neutrality. South Korean President Moon Jae-in pledged more international aid.
We will provide more assistance to developing countries to lay tailored green growth policies. Countries have their own stages of economic development and thus they also differ on the dependence on coal power. Certainly more assistance is needed to transition into a low carbon economy.
Outside, critics point out that South Korea continues constructing and exporting coal-fired power plants, which generate the most CO2 emissions of all fossil fuels globally, about 30%. South Korea's pledge to end coal power financing. Climate change scientists agree that the COVID-19 pandemic and its lockdowns reduced human activity, which caused a reduction in CO2 emissions. But that reduction in climate-changing pollution will be short-lived. As people drive back to work, factories reopen, and airlines resume their pre-pandemic flight schedules. As the forum took place, environmental activists marched to the venue, critical of the government's carbon record and a new green growth plan to cut down old growth forest to replant young carbon-absorbing trees.
The P4G summit talks about solidarity for green growth, but the climate crisis talks that count on growth are wrong from the start. The current climate crisis is the result of infinite growth for the nation and capital, for power and greed. Even if you put green in front of growth, that's just whitewashing the truth.
P4G Partnering for Green Growth and Global Goals links with the UN's 2030 Sustainable Development Goals, which focus on 17 international crises. Urgent action on climate change is number 13. Frank Smith, Seoul.
To work in Afghanistan as a journalist, one needs to be ready for facing horrifying scenarios. From being taken as hostage by the terrorist groups or powerful local commanders to becoming a victim of a blast. It was 4 years ago, on May 31st, that a massive bomb explosion killed or wounded over 600 individuals, mostly civilians. Among the victims was Habibullah Hussein Zadeh, Press TV's cameraman in Kabul.
4 years ago, during the holy month of Ramadan, a major Daesh bomb blast hit the green zone of Kabul. Habib was on his way to the office. Unfortunately, he was killed as he was close to the blast site. We found his dead body in a hospital 6 days later.
The death of Habib was not the first tragic incident for Press TV staff in Kabul. Prior to losing Habib, Press TV Bureau in Kabul had already lost Sayed Farhad Taqaddusi, another cameraman who lost his life after a rocket hit Press TV's office during a complex Taliban attack back in 2011. Sayed Mohsin Husseini remembers how all of his colleagues were shocked when a rocket hit their office in Kabul's heavily protected area.
It was in October 2011 when the Taliban launched a coordinated attack in the heavily protected area of Kabul. One of their rockets hit our office, and we lost our brave cameraman Sayed Farhad. We are committed to following the footsteps of our martyrs.
Let's not forget that the media groups in Afghanistan are facing many challenges, from the shortage of financial resources to security threats that have forced over 300 journalists and media staff to either quit their jobs or leave the country. Based on official figures, over 133 journalists and media workers in Afghanistan have been killed and many others have been wounded over the past 15 months. According to the 2021 World Press Freedom Index, released by Reporters Without Borders, Afghanistan is still considered one of the most dangerous countries for journalists and reporters around the world. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
In a rare move, Iran's oil ministry has delegated a major oil project to local companies with the aim to boost crude oil production, as U.S. sanctions still cast their shadows on the country's petroleum sector. Worth $1.3 billion, the development project aims to boost the output in the Azadegan oil field to 320,000 barrels per day, up from the existing 140,000 BPDs.
We're running our oil industry amid the U.S. sanctions that seek to destroy the strategic sector. We're not allowed to import a single oil pipe. This is why we have made the greatest achievements during this difficult period. We continue to develop our oil fields to increase our output. We have done it before and we will do it now.
Azadegan oil field is located in southwest Iran and is in the vicinity of Iraq-Iran border. Its in-place oil capacity is estimated to be around 33 billion barrels, but with the current pace, only 1.5 billion barrels are recoverable. In 2009, China's oil giant CNPC won a $2.5 billion deal with Iran's oil ministry to expedite the recovery rate in the oil field. But in 2014, Iran revoked the deal due to China's foot dragging in fulfilling the project. Local firms say the move to handle such a mega project domestically is unprecedented in the history of the oil industry in Iran. In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear deal and the reimposition of sanctions in 2018. Iran's oil output almost halved to 1.9 million barrels a day. As a result, Iran's exports have dropped to less than 1 million barrels per day, down from 2.5 million prior to the U.S.'s pullout from the nuclear deal. Now, the signing of these contracts is in line with plans to double oil production to 4.5 billion barrels a day in the next year.
As U.S. oil embargoes are still haunting Iran's crude, Tehran is resorting to domestic firms to keep the strategic sector up and running. Given the vast oil reserves waiting to be tapped into in the Azadegan oil field, experts say the development of the key reservoir means a significant boost to Iran's oil production and a strong comeback to the global market. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepest me alive. and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Debate.
Hello, welcome to the debate. Why do far-right extremist ideologies have a presence in the British military? Or should the question be, why is there such an attraction for far-right ideology from UK servicemen and UK soldiers? These soldiers, Air Force and Naval personnel were among those who were investigated, actually, the past 2.5 years under PREVENT, a program which aims to stop people from becoming radicalized. Yet these very same service members need to be the role models for the rest to follow. Far-right extremism in the UK military and service members, the subject of this edition of the debate.
Armed Forces allure for far-right extremists is believed to be as old as British fascism's earliest incarnations. At least 16 members of the country's armed forces investigated over the past 2.5 years have been referred to the UK's so-called PREVENT scheme, a controversial terrorism prevention program.
The British Army is seen as being a defense of Britain and British values, but those British values are rooted in racism, as I say, and also in its history of colonialism and empire. The British military is in itself a racist institution because Britain is a racist society.
The UK Ministry of Defence is yet to release exact figures, but it says the number of investigations in 2020 was less than 10, and those so far this year, less than 5. Critics say, despite the MOD's stated commitment to zero tolerance for far-right extremists operating within the armed forces, its strong words have not always led to strong action.
Of course the British government is going to say there's a zero tolerance policy, but that is nothing in keeping with the reality when it comes to the culture that exists within the British Army because of its role, because of its history, because of its legacy, and because of its identity. The far right is on the march, not just in the UK, but throughout the West. This is a result of the socio-economic problems ushered in by the 2008 economic collapse, and the far right have been able to point the fingers at migrants and refugees and existing minority communities as being the problem. I think that this is just the tip of the iceberg. I think it goes far, far deeper, and I think there's a cover-up abroad in consequence.
Of the 14 investigations carried out in 2019 into serving armed forces personnel, a staggering 11 stemmed from far-right concerns. And those concerns have been fueled by images such as this one from 2019, British paratroopers using pictures of former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn for target practice, or this video from a year earlier of notorious far-right English Defence League founder known as Tommy Robinson surrounded by a group of young infantrymen.
Last year, the UK's top counter-terrorism officer said the fastest-growing UK terrorist threat came from the far right. A year later, the threat is still there, with critics saying the government is not taking the threat seriously enough. Saeed Bouriza, London.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, Ian Williams, is senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, joining us from New York. We also have Sayed Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, joining us from London. Welcome to you both. Sayed Mohsen Abbas, let me first start with you. Let me ask a general question first. In terms of the UK as a whole, does the UK have a problem with far-right groups and extreme or far-right ideology?
It certainly does have a problem with far-right. Of course, the coronavirus and COVID-19 have kind of overtaken the headlines. That doesn't mean that such organizations don't exist or have stopped operating. Far from it. It was very clear that these organizations were now at the stage of becoming militarily and, arms-wise, completely ready to take various action. And we've seen evidence of violent extremism of that kind across Europe. But in England, whilst it hasn't manifested in a mass killing as such, what has happened is the rallies that these organizations, like the EDL, you know, the English Defence League, and various others, have begun to get more and more nasty and vicious. I know of journalists, seasoned journalists, who've dealt with this issue, you know, racism, the far right, and the kind of violent far right, if you like. They've been dealing with them for decades. Around last year, one of those journalists very openly confided me and said, look, it's no longer safe for me to actually go to the rallies and the demonstrations because these people have gone to another level and I'm worried about my life. She was seriously saying that actually she felt threatened in terms of her own life by becoming too, if you like, engaging with these far-right organizations. That's the state of the rallies and those gatherings. Can you imagine behind the scenes what may be going on in terms of the organization, the planning, the strategic directions that they might be receiving? And what worries me even more is that this climate of hate, which has been created by not just far-right organizations, but rather by the British media, by British institutions, the political institutions themselves, which are overtly racist and Islamophobic. Boris Johnson, you only have to recall his statements around women in letterboxes for women who wear niqabs, for instance, to give you an indication of just how Islamophobic and racist the leadership itself is at the moment. Well, as it filters down into the more nasty elements, of course, that sentiment becomes one of action. The military, of course, uh-huh. is a place where people can get trained. And that's what's most worrying about these figures and the inaction of the government. So, yes, Britain has a huge problem of Islamophobia, which it sweeps under the carpet. And, of course, the cutting edge of that will be the rise of these terrorist right-wing groups.
Okay. Well, let's get to that, Ian Williams. You have soldiers, Air Force, and naval personnel who were among those that were investigated. The report covered that. It was over the course of 2.5 years under a program called PREVENT, which investigates far-right extremism and UK soldiers. Does the fact that this program was required to be launched show that there was actually a problem within the UK military personnel with radicalization?
I'm somewhat amazed that they only investigated 11 or 14. If that's the scale of the problem, then it's under control. But I don't believe that. I believe they're only investigating the most egregious examples. What struck me is that people have resurrected. There's a checklist that the army itself produced for almost 5 years ago on indicators and warnings for extreme right wing. And looking through that checklist, most of the present conservative cabinet were probably qualified. Certainly most of the American Congress would. A lot of the police would. I mean, they describe, it says that, look for individuals, it says, for people in the military who describe themselves as patriots. Look for people who describe their opponents as traitors. Look at people who use the term Islamofascism. You know, and you look at people ready to challenge their views as indoctrinated. You refer to political correctness as some left-wing or communist plot. Top marks whoever drew up this list. It's fairly effective and comprehensive, and it applies to a considerable degree of American society, British society, and newspaper editors as well. To put this in perspective, recently something like half, I think it was, with the French gendarmerie said that they would be voting for Le Pen, you know, a descendant of the Vichy regime in Germany were there. So, you know, I think Britain has a problem, but I don't think it's completely unique. The question is, how do you combat it? There is always an attraction from the right wing for military uniforms and new shout patriotism. The redeeming grace in the British Army is that they can't get enough recruits.
Well, let me jump in here, Williams. I'd like to find out from you, because I'd like to actually have you clarify this. Is it, in terms of the attraction, is it coming from, as you mentioned, the far-right groups who are going after military personnel, or are military personnel attracted to the far-right ideology, and then they become radicalized? Because there is a difference here.
I think they're mutually reinforcing processes. You know, Britain's never had a real tradition of idolatry for the military the way that the Americans have, for example. If you go to Britain and say, I'm a veteran, they say, so? You're retired, what's your problem? You know, the veterans are not put on a pedestal. If somebody said, I serve, they say, so? There's a sort of pragmatic attitude that doesn't glorify the military, despite the best efforts of the Sun, the Express, and the rest of the press. The military are more a normal part of society. But it is getting complicated by the fact that, and it's been 40 years since there was conscription in Britain. It's a professional army. People volunteer to join, you know, the forces in general. And the military, the actual army tends to be less skilled, let us say. You need a degrees of skill to be a sailor or an air forceman. And these are people who very likely couldn't get jobs elsewhere, and they're recruited. They tend to come from those sectors of society which tend to that those views anyway. But I've got to say, I've been with the British military and other militaries on UN peacekeeping forces, you know, reporting, and I've never seen really overt racism, casual racism of the kind that I expected, frankly. Partly because they're so mixed in themselves. Unless you're in the top guards regiments, it reflects the society, which is a multi-ethnic one. But yes, there have been lots of reports of real racism against the two paratroopers. One a court case on discrimination a year or so ago because of the racist treatment they were getting. I think the real issue is whether the officers and the military establishment take it serious enough to combat it, and they don't nudge and wink at it. But it's bound to be a serious problem. And remember, this is the military that some of whose members were alleged to be plotting a coup against Harold Wilson because he was such a left-wing prime minister. Pragmatic social democrat ever, and the military will work with newspaper proprietors.
Well, we're gonna get to some examples of some of these military personnel in a second. But it's interesting, Ian Williams, that you say, could the figures actually be higher? You kind of posed that question, and Said Mohsen Abbas, I'd like to expand on that, because it seems like it is, based on Nick Lowles, who's Hope Not Hate's chief executive. He has said the referrals of so many serving military personnel to prevent the program and general rise, then he went on to say, of violent far-right extremism in society as a whole. So that right there kind of points to the fact that the numbers couldn't just be 14 cases. This could be a lot higher. Do you think that they're trying to conceal this figure, limiting it to it being reported to just 14 cases?
Inevitably, institutions will cover their own back.
This is for you, Samos. Go ahead.
Sorry. I think it's inevitable that, you know, institutions in Britain or anywhere across the West that I know would try to suppress or deflect or cover up the kind of endemic institutionalized racism that exists within them. I mean, the Met Police here have been caught out so many times. Statistics exist left, right, and center. It's not been resolved. It's not been dealt with in an adequate manner. The British military is no different. I think it's just even probably more secretive and even more capable of making excuses to cover these things up in the interests, well, in the national interest, I would imagine. But look, we know for a fact, of course, that as my colleague said, the kind of people that do get recruited in the lower ranks of the British Army, they come from the kind of backgrounds where they're not exactly going to be blessed with great knowledge or history, historical knowledge of either the areas they go to, or nor is it actually probably part of their training. I've dealt with the British military at one level. They do have a section which deals with cultural, if you like, issues, so that the soldiers could better adapt to environments like Afghanistan, for instance, or Iraq, or all the umpteenth number of other places which essentially NATO, the British, the Americans have been going and spreading their own particular form of democracy. As we know, across the Muslim world, we've been blessed with British, American, and other troops coming in to give us democracy, give them supposedly human rights, peace initiatives. What tends to end up happening is brutal war and the indiscriminate killing of civilians on an absolutely industrial scale, whether it's in Iraq, Afghanistan, and beyond. Millions have been subject to that kind of process. Uh-huh. Now, the soldiers that go there, of course, their job is not to empathize or sympathize. It's there to do the job that they're given to do. Now, that job is essentially at the extreme end, kill people. That's what the job of an army is. And the kind of people that you recruit to do that really don't ask too many questions. So the blowback from such an ongoing, if you like, imperialist or British/American, I call it Anglo imperialism across the entire Muslim world, in particular, or the Middle East, essentially, to protect the British interests, has been all about being brutal, really, and all about being very cold, callous in the interests of British economics, policy, or the politics. So,
okay,
these soldiers really are part and parcel of a machine which is creating blowback, the blowback which can come back to Britain in many, many shapes and forms. And of course, when you've got a society which has been groomed now on the idea of ISIS and Islam being one and the same, terrorism in our own capitals here in the West being linked directly to Muslims, migrants, as was mentioned earlier, and add to that such things as Brexit and the nationalism of the Scots, there is a growing environment of if you like, hatred and fear and, right, and insularity, which I think can be taken advantage of by anybody inside institutions or outside British institutions.
Well, let's talk about a case here that is pretty jaw-dropping in Williams, and it involves two naval personnel, which included one who was due to work on a Trident nuclear submarine, and they were exposed as members of the far-right identitarian movement. It's a movement which has links to a banned terrorist organization. I'm just, you know, I'm curious as to how, what kind of vetting process could there have been, or what kind of, how could that
well,
go under
found,
the radar?
So the vetting process is there and working. Look, if these right groups wanted to go deep undercover, they wouldn't allow their infiltrators to show their colors in public like that. This is, if you remember, the Bolsheviks infiltrated the Tsarist army, which is one of the reasons for the Russian Revolution. they subverted the army. If people want power, they can infiltrate people in there. One of the pluses of Britain is that the army has relatively been out of politics. We haven't mentioned, but we also have to consider the deleterious effect of 30 or 40 years of the troubles in Ireland, where the army was involved in secret undercover activities and was actually fighting against what, on the face of it, were their own people. Because if you want to be callous about it, it's one thing for them to go out to the Empire and shoot up people in Arden and Cyprus and Kenya. It's when they come back and transfer those activities back home that it becomes, how should we say, a threat to the body politic. I'm not saying it's good, but when the army gets used to shooting their own people and infiltrating, right, their own people and taking part in active politics in their own political system, as they did in Ireland. That is a very worrying trend. And, you know, it doesn't in any way condone the overt racism about ethnic minorities, but the Irish thing has really twisted the British force, the British Army, because the Air Force and Navy weren't involved much.
I got two important questions to ask, but I unfortunately have a couple minutes here on Saint Mohsen Abbas. I'm going to take this one question, which shook the entire UK, and that was when the British police officer who was charged with the murder of Sarah Everard, if you remember that, I'm sure. You know, you have a police officer that mentally somehow something went wrong. So I'm curious, this is the type of radicalization that is a result of perhaps the psyche, the UK service member or police in this case, psyche, going into that radicalization, being brainwashed in a sense to be that way, which results in this type of incident. Is that a deduction that can be made?
I think that there is far more evidence, as I said, on the ground of people who are prepared to do things. But of course, we live in an era now where these fellows are technologically literate. They're being developed, arguably also by strategists from across Europe. It's even possible, and this has been mooted by certain circles, allegedly, that actually even deep state, British deep state itself, is allowing some of these groups to continue their activities, and they know perfectly well that they're armed and ready. But actually, these sort of right-wing groups could serve a purpose, and in fact, they're allowed to continue because they counteract certain other forces in society. So this notion that MI6, MI5, and the security services don't know about these organizations and can't shut them down, to me, is incredible. I think that they could easily hunt down all of these groups and pick them up and pretty much shut down the whole situation. I mean, the fact that a Lance Corporal in 2018, Mikko Vivalinen, I think, joined a group called the neo-Nazi, well, it was a neo-Nazi group, National Action, and still joined the army, is a worrying sign. But actually, it's the ones who are covert and who haven't showed themselves to be within these kind of racist, overtly racist and violently extreme organizations that are more worrying, because I think there's a huge underbelly of those folk who are ready to take action against British citizens and beyond.
Okay. I can squeeze in a 30-second answer to you, Ian Williams. My other question has to deal with the way that the UK has actually defined this whole extremism, its definition, which some are saying is controversial and weak in terms of the way that it has defined it. The current government's been decried as unfit for purpose, some have said, with some far-right groups even using it to their advantage. Is that the case? 30 seconds.
Yes, they are looking after it. What our enemy here is lack of transparency and impunity for the security forces and the police forces. The idea that they can do whatever they like and they're not subject to scrutiny and their personnel will get an easy ride. It's the same as the police departments in the US. It's the same with the security services everywhere in the world.
Unfortunately, I got to jump in here. We're just fresh out of time. That's Ian Williams talking there, senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus. Thank you. And Saeed Mohsen Abbas, thank you so much, journalist and political commentator. And that does it for this edition of Debate. From Mikhail Tahway and the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In memory of a magnetic man. The 14th of the Iranian month of Khordad, falling on Friday, 4th of June this year, is indeed a doleful day. It is the day when the Islamic Republic of Iran was orphaned with the departure from this mortal world of its founder. It is the day when 32 years ago, millions of mournful Iranians gave a fitting farewell to the person who rescued them from domestic hegemony and foreign hegemony. The person, whose arrest in 1963 had triggered the 15th of Khordad or the 5th of June uprising, left for his heavenly abode on the eve of the 26th anniversary of this event that changed Iran's destiny. He, however, did not leave Iran, Iranians, and the world's oppressed in the dark. He bequeathed to them a rich and lasting legacy, and an able successor, who continues to be the hope and support of all aspirants to truth, social justice, and independence. This was the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, whose mausoleum, though empty this year of the usual multitudinous gatherings because of the coronavirus pandemic, continues to rule the hearts of not just the Iranian nation, but of conscientious masses throughout the world. A magnetic personality, he needs no introduction. Born in 1902 in the town of Khomein in central Iran, to the local religious leader, Sayyid Mustafa Musavi al-Hindi, he was named Ruhullah in honor of Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, whom Muslims hail as the Spirit of God. He lost his father early on in life, but like all great men, strove with faith in God and self-confidence to acquire knowledge, piety, patience, prudence, and skills in management that continued to contribute to his lasting legacy and charisma, although he is no longer in our midst physically. His uprising against tyranny, exile to Turkey and from there to Iraq, and return home in triumph in February of 1979 as the leader of the Islamic Revolution are all vivid in our memories. His determination defeated an armed-to-the-teeth regime, although he did not carry any weapon with him. When circumstances made him assume charge of Iran, he was already an accomplished scholar, a leading jurisprudent, and Gnostic of the highest order, who, with reliance upon God during the 10 years he was at the helm of the affairs until his departure from this mortal world in June of 1989, completely transformed Iran into a strong, dignified and truly independent country, capable of resisting the plots and pressures of the arrogant powers. This makes us recall a famous hadith mentioned in Bihar al-Anwar, the Hadith Encyclopedia, from Imam Musa Kazem, peace be upon him. A man from Qom will rise up and invite people towards truth. Around him will gather people like slabs of iron resolve, who will stand firm against strong winds and storms, and will never get tired of war. They know not fear, and have trust in Allah. The outcome is for the pious. Study of this statement expressed over a millennium and 2 centuries ago by an infallible Imam, Imam Musa Kazem, peace be upon him, shows that no such event had occurred in Qom throughout all these centuries, until 1963, when Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, raised his voice against the godless Pahlavi regime. The Pahlavi regime was installed by the British and backed to the hilt by the Americans in order to keep the Muslim nation of Iran in thrall. True to the words of this hadith, if the despots and the hegemonic powers quaked at the uprising of this man of God, the seekers of truth responded to his call and rallied to his side with iron resolve to establish a model Islamic government of the modern era and to heroically defend it for 8 years during the war that the United States has imposed on Iran through his stooge, Saddam of the Ba'athist minority regime in Baghdad. He was not a cult leader, nor did he aspire to become one, and neither do those who keep alive his memory are trying to make a demigod out of him. In fact, as should be clear, this humble scholar of the school of the Ahlul Bayt of the Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, put into practice the heritage of Islamic learning and strove to enlighten mankind with higher humanitarian ideals and values, which are conspicuously absent in bodies and souls burdened with animal instincts and traits. This was where the iconoclast came into open conflict with the materialistic West, especially the great Satan, the United States, and its blinkered vision of life and culture. This was where godless capitalism floundered against Islamic resurgence. The 19th century had seen the indefatigable Sayyid Jamaluddin Asadabadi hounded across countries and continents by the British and their surrogates for his efforts to resuscitate Muslim societies with the spirit of pan-Islamism. But here was Imam Khomeini and his followers of iron resolve frustrating every sinister plot to tarnish the image of Islam that devilish minds could conceive. The man who foresaw the doom of communism and whose dynamic decree hangs like the sword of Damocles on the head of apostasy has also spoken of his views on economy, on politics, on arts, industry, culture, science and religion, all of which function as an integrated whole in human life. Perhaps Iran may not have yet reached the ideal stage of a truly Islamic state, as desired by Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. But the change he wrought has been positively profound, with society cleansed of all vestiges of acts and practices that are considered open violation of the principles of Sharia law. Imam Khomeini took dynamic steps to uplift the status of women and restore to Iranian women their dignity, which the Pahlavi regime had brutally trampled upon by exposing their delicate feminine features to the plots and brazen attacks of depraved Western culture. He focused on solidarity by building the bridge of Islamic Unity Week to span the 12th and 17th of the month of Rabiul Awwal, the 2 days regarded by the two main sects of Islam respectively as the birthday of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. He declared the last Friday of the fasting month of Ramadan as International Quds Day in order to garner support for Islam's first Qibla, that is, the city of Bayt al-Muqaddas, which is under Zionist occupation. He issued the historic verdict against apostasy when the Indian-born British apostate Salman Rushdie, with the backing of the West and the Zionists, dared to deride the sacred tenets of Islam. Perhaps one of the most brilliant measures of Imam Khomeini was the concept of walayat al-faqih, or governance of the supreme jurisprudent, in the physical absence of the Imam of the age, the Holy Prophet's 12th and last successor, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, to establish a global government of peace, prosperity and justice. What Muslim philosophers such as Abu Nas Farabi had envisioned in their writings on the concept of the perfect state and the ideal ruler for human societies, and what God-fearing religious scholars or ulama and the pious believers had yearned for in every age, Imam Khomeini proceeded to give perfection to these rudiments of the rule of the righteous as the concept of walayat al-faqih, or the rule of the supreme jurisprudent. It was his conviction that authority in state matters was not the prerogative of the infirm in faith, the unprincipled, the immoral, and the unjust, and on the basis of the hadith that the fuqaha are the true heirs of the prophets. Today, Sayyid Ruhullah Khomeini is no longer with us, but his thoughts and ideas are very much alive, especially the blueprint of Islamic government, which has all the characteristics of a catalyst for aspiring Muslim countries. It is this magnetism that gains new adherents every day around the world and sends shivers down the spine of those masquerading as defenders of democracy and human rights. Condolences to all on the passing away anniversary of the father of the Islamic Revolution. Here at Arabi English Radio, express our heartfelt condolences to all of our listeners. On the 32nd anniversary of the passing away of the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul.